Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I'm not sure when you're going to hear this yet. Today, as I'm recording this, it's April 1st. So I'm on, you know, high alert for people's little pranks, and you should be too, but you're kind of hearing about this after it's probably too late. But yeah, threat level red or yellow, orange, whatever's high for me today. I'm on the lookout. Real tricksters out there. Anyway, listen, I wanted to start the show today by reading an email that you got from a fan, Brett, or a listener. I don't like the word fan. Participants. Those are words I like better. No, from a client. So I tutored this girl for the SAT. Been kind of talking with the mom off and on about doing some tutoring. The younger brother. And this showed up in my inbox just the other day. And it's from mom. Brett, I just stumbled across your website. Do I have sound effects? Hold on. Sound effects. Right? Because that's the problem. This is what we've been worried about since 2009. Or I shouldn't say we. I don't think you devote a lot of time to worrying about this. Since 2009, when I started the show in August, I was very, very concerned that there was going to be this crossover. And I was very, very suspicious one time that it had happened. I was working with this tiger mom who wanted, like, tutoring. Her ninth grade daughter got a B in algebra, and it was a crisis. So she said, where can I get information about you online? This might have been like the beginning of 2010. And couldn't be like, well, I'm not going to give you my name. So I did, and I never heard from them again. So, but for the most part, these two professional pursuits, the podcast and, you know, I was a vice president of a tutoring business for a long time, really overlapped until, in a way that I was sure of, until I got this email. So, Brett, I just stumbled across your website, and I am so impressed by your School Sucks project. Wow. I fully support and agree with your philosophy, and I too am concerned about how the public education system single-handedly strips young people of their greatest qualities, especially in the absence of family environments that encourage individuality, curiosity, creativity, and taking risks. The one thing schools should teach kids is how to learn as a life skill, and it doesn't. Don't even get me going about the hyper-focus on athletics overshadowing the development of character, intellect, and personal responsibility. And yes, I understand that athletics can help in some way. I am moved to help or support your initiative in some way. I will figure out how, because it was not a coincidence that I stumbled onto it. For starters, if you have any use for a very capable, unpaid intern for a few hours this summer, I can think of one very motivated, smart, and creative college freshman who will be coming home in a couple of months. Now, is that cool? Isn't that cool? All right. So today on the show, and I feel like there's more news. I feel like there's, I'm in a bidding war right now on eBay to get a Symmetrex 528E voice processor. I'll let you know how that goes, too. Those are the preamps that Ian uses on Free Talk Live, and he's got them all in this rack, and it looks really cool. I want to get one for this mic. I need it. So that's happening, and that's about it. This is a show that I did with a listener before I went to Arizona, a listener named Tony, who lives and works in Turkey, and Turkey is certainly a hotbed right now, but what's new? It has been for over 1,000 years. And I have to say, I didn't really know that much about the country of Turkey, including what's going on there currently. So our discussion meanders here and there. We talk a lot about Tony's experience teaching in the United States before he moved to Turkey. And I enjoyed this chat. I wasn't sure how in-depth we were going to go into the whole Turkey situation. I mean, most of what I know about Turkey, aside from, you know, sort of medieval history of Turkey, is Operation Gladio. Have you heard about this? This was kind of anti-Soviet, at least ostensibly, anti-Soviet terror campaign organized by NATO in the CIA in the middle of the last century after World War II. And Turkey was heavily involved in this. In fact, there was a term that I learned and remembered because I really liked it. And I think it said a lot in just two words. And the term was deep state. Now, I haven't done any looking into Operation Gladio for a long time. And while I was just trying to do some research, we actually didn't even get into this stuff, but I found an article on Voice of America called Turkey Fears Deep State Return. And this is about the current political turmoil in that country. But let's just go to Wikipedia first and give you the basics of deep state. The deep state, Turkish, in Turkish, Derin Devlet, is alleged to be a group of influential anti-democratic, also anti-freedom, coalitions within the Turkish political system composed of high-level elements within the intelligence services, domestic and foreign, Turkish military, security, judiciary, and mafia. Because why not? The notion of deep state is similar to that of a state within a state. For those who believe in its existence, the political agenda of deep state involves an allegiance to nationalism, corporatism, and state interests. Violence and other means of pressure have historically been employed in a largely covert manner to manipulate political and economic elites and ensure specific interests are met within the seemingly democratic framework of the political landscape. Former President Süleyman Demirel says that the outlook and behavior of the predominantly military elites who constitute the deep state and work to uphold national interests are shaped by an entrenched belief dating back to the fall of the Ottoman Empire that the country is always on the brink. And that is something that we are going to discuss today. And I always remember this term and like this term, like the descriptive power, because that's not something that's foreign to the United States. If you haven't heard, or if you're not an AV Club member and you haven't heard our research discussion on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK, I highly recommend it. I believe Richard Grove has included it in one of his Peace Revolution podcasts for free at this point. So if you like this kind of intrigue, I recommend going and checking that out. So let me just share this article before we get into this today. Voice of America, Turkey Fears Deep State Return. This was written by Dorian Jones a week ago. Dateline Istanbul. The release of retired senior military figures and crime bosses in Turkey is prompting the concern that the country's so-called deep state could return. A legal reform introduced by the Turkish government has seen dozens of retired military officers and members of the country's criminal underworld released from jail. Many have been convicted of crimes linked to what prosecutors have termed Derin Devlet, or deep state, unofficial networks of powers that prosecutors claim are responsible for political assassinations of people considered to be enemies of the state. Cengiz Aktar of Istanbul Policy Forum said the releases were worrisome. Quote, "The Turkish public opinion is extremely worried about these releases because these people might think about taking revenge in the months to come," said Aktar. Among those released are people convicted of assassinating prominent Armenian journalist Hanrat Dink. Prosecutors allege that the killers of three missionaries have also been released. Others are accused of forming death squads within the security forces. But human rights groups said most of the victims of crimes committed by Turkey's so-called deep state were activists fighting for Kurdish minority rights, including during the 1990s at the height of the fighting between the Turkish state and the Kurdish rebel group PKK. Several offices of the pro-Kurdish People's Democracy Party have been attacked by Turkish nationalists this month during local election campaigns. The party's leader, and if he's listening and that's not the correct pronunciation, I am sorry, Ertuğrul Kerkü, said the deep state organization was involved. "This group is the major mastermind behind these attacks. They, of course, did not lead those attacks while they were in prison. But this is the remnants of this group, which has been very active in the past atrocities against the Kurds and Democrats," he said. Kerkü and many other political observers says the government has released individuals linked to Turkey's deep state in a bid to enlist its support in its battle against followers of an Islamic cleric, Fethullah Gülen, who lives in self-imposed exile in the United States. The government accused his followers of infiltrating sections of judiciary and police. Sinan Yuljin, a visiting scholar of Carnegie Europe, doubted the government would take such a risky move. He blamed the releases on shortcomings within the judiciary. Quote, from the standpoint from the government, this was also an unwarranted development because most of Turkish society is critical with its development, he said. Certainly, some of the people who have been associated with Turkey's deep state can regroup, but I don't think that it's possible anymore because there has been fundamental change in the civil-military relationship, and that will not change, unquote. Political scientist Akhtar acknowledged that Turkey has changed from the time when the military directly intervened in politics. But he said with the government having purged thousands of police officers and members of the judiciary in its battle against Gulen's followers, Turkey remains vulnerable to political intrigue. Quote, the police and justice have been shaken and destabilized. Therefore, we don't know who will ensure the public order. With that many criminals there in the streets of the country, it is very worrisome, said Akhtar. Human rights groups accused Turkey's deep state of thousands of political deaths and disappearances during the 1990s. So, I hope you find this show interesting. We're going to start talking about Tony's experiences in the United States, both in New York as a public school teacher in the Bronx, and some of his college experience. In fact, let's start there. College experience. Reed College. Here we go. I hope you enjoy this. Thanks, everyone, and take care.
When I listened to your talk with Thaddeus Russell, and he talked about Antioch, and I went to a school just like Antioch, but the way, as I think I introduced it in an email to you, to Reed College is sort of a very interesting place. It has an unofficial school motto of free love, anarchy, and communism.
Where is it?
It's in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard of Jack Kerouac and the Beatniks.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, one of his book, I think it was Dharma Bums, where one of the characters is Jaffe Ryder. That was a real person whose name was Gary Snyder. He's a famous Zen poet. So the whole beat scene, Reed College was a real part of that. And Reed has very close ties to University of Chicago. And
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, it's – and I have this – you know, as I've thought about things and I've listened to a lot of the stuff that Jan Ervin's put out, I'm – you know, I think that Reed is also part of that picture that Jan Ervin has been painting about the creation of the counterculture.
With the deadheads and all that?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and yeah. Reed itself was full of – I mean, we had a joke, and perhaps you're familiar with being out east, that, you know – polls that the student had, the bigger his trust fund was at Reed.
Say that one more time.
The bigger, the more holes that the student had in his clothes.
Yeah.
The joke was that he was. Yeah, it was the bigger trustafarian that he was.
Sure. Yeah. You see a lot of that in Vermont too.
Yeah. And I mean, one thing that's funny to me about Reed is the story was that in the late 60s, early 70s, someone from the university wrote some cultural department in the Soviet Union portraying Reed as having been founded by John Reed, you know, the guy who wrote 10 Days That Shook the World. You know, he was played by Warren Beatty in the movie Reds. So very famous, sort of one of those Americans who went to the Soviet Union and said it was a great thing and we should all become communists. And evidently the story is that the Soviet Union sent the college a bunch of, you know, agricultural videos or something like this. But it was just a very But the things that Thaddeus Russell said about Antioch is essentially, if you were a white straight man in the 90s, you were your time.
Yeah, no, your time had passed. Right. You had your chance. You know, man.
And so there is this sense of like, wow, I wish I were this or that. And, you know, this basically wanting to be some sort of victim that had some sort of, you know, badge of oppression too.
Yeah. You know, and when I say that the we had our time, I don't mean like to in any way to sound apologetic for what was going on there. That real progressive affirmative action over correctiveness. And I don't mean like politically correct, but I mean they seek this corrective course, but, you know, not an acknowledgement of what happened and learning why things happen and understanding, you know, the prevailing philosophies or even trying to understand the psychology of a mass psychology, if people believe in such a thing, of a time period or of a certain place where there was injustice or atrocity. All that is kind of covered up. And the tactics and the ideological approach is just constantly undermining the people they claim to help in so many ways by sweeping like the real struggles of these people and the real opportunities to have empathy for these struggles completely under the carpet. So, I mean, I'm saying that, yeah, the white man did have plenty of time in history, sure. But what you're describing, what Thaddeus Russell described about Antioch is offensive.
That was being, you know, there was a song that Jackson Browne put out in the 70s called The Pretender, and there's a line in that: I met all the fools that a young fool meets. And that really, my time at Reed just makes me think about that, because this, you know, you have this idealism and wanting to, you know, recognizing all of this injustice. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, and I was actually planning to join the military, go to West Point. And fortunately in high school, I was on my way to doing it. I was an Eagle Scout. I was going to meetings. I was a varsity football quarterback. I was a valedictorian. I had all my ducks lined up to go put in 20 years for the military and retire when I was 38. I had it all lined up, and except for the fact that, you know, I would be a soldier. And someone, you know, I fell in love in high school, and this person in my life changed, because I realized, oh, maybe there's something else that I might like to do. And then when I got to university, it started to, you know, realize, wow, you know, all that John Wayne shit that I'd grown up on and Clint Eastwood and all that stuff, that's, you know, a lot of that was horse shit. And so go the complete opposite direction of all, you know, so everything is good to everything is terrible. And, you know, it's essentially two sides of the same coin of, and this is one of the things that I really appreciate about, you know, the work that you do in your show and trying to be thoughtful about all of these things. It's so necessary. I think that there's, you know, to bring this back to schools, it's so clear that there is a need for learning about, you know, who we are and what we've done and where we're going and all that stuff. And it's just, you know, it's just so difficult in midst of all of the madness and the nonsense and the lies. And
it's even difficult once you start. I mean, it's difficult to start amidst all that stuff. It's difficult while you're doing it. You know, it's difficult to figure things out. It's difficult to confront certain things. Yeah, but it is also pretty rewarding. So I appreciate you saying that. So rare is the opportunity that I get to speak to a real former public school teacher. This conversation with Tony will prove that I continue to be very good at making friends with former public school teachers, but not very good at all at making friends with current public school teachers, which is something I will work on. But Tony, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for reaching out.
Ah, thank you. It's a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this. I've been following your show for quite a while, so I'm happy to be a part of it.
So you wrote to me and said that you have this unique experience that we're going to talk about today. You're in Turkey, and there's a lot of things that I want to know about that experience and that environment. But your background was here in the States. So do you want to just fill us in on, like, you know, where you trained and where you started? Because you were a public school teacher in New York at one point.
Sure. I started out, actually, I backed into it in a way. I was doing a master's degree in conflict resolution in Portland, Oregon, at Portland State University. And part of the master's degree required a practicum. And since I'd been interested in working with young people and teaching and schools and so forth, I decided to do my practicum in a elementary school through AmeriCorps. Mm-hmm. And I essentially was a mentor, and I also did a small violence prevention aspect of teaching in the classrooms. But mostly I hung out with the fifth and sixth graders, boys, who the school had sort of identified as needing some extra guidance. And so I went there a few hours a week, hung out with the kids, And it was in that experience that I realized that if I wanted to get into schools that mostly being a teacher rather than as some sort of a specialist would be the better thing. And so when I graduated from Portland State with my master's in conflict resolution, I subsequently got a teaching position in New York City through New York City's version of Teach for America.
So we've identified a couple of things that I just want to go into in a little bit more detail here. First of all, for those who are unfamiliar, what is AmeriCorps?
Well, it's essentially, I believe it was a program that was started in the Clinton era. Mm-hmm. And the idea of it is more or less like a Peace Corps for the United States. I mean, essentially, there are nonprofits in general that I guess also the public school system uses them, where they apply for grants and they get grant money from the government. Basically, if you think about what the Peace Corps does around the world, the idea was to do that sort of stuff in the United States. So working in schools, working in environmental issues, a whole, basically, if you could write a grant that the AmeriCorps thought was worthwhile, I assume they would throw you some money.
Sure.
There's part-time versions of it. There's full-time versions. It comes with a small stipend and some money for school, basically.
Interesting. And Teach for America, I was definitely familiar with, and this is something that people encouraged me to look into when I was thinking about pursuing this as a career. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Teach for America is a national program, and it services basically schools, public schools, where they can't get enough teachers. So it's generally poor rural areas and inner cities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and it's generally you go and they give you a boot camp training in the summer, and then you start off teaching in the classroom. Some of the programs, so for example, New York City had its own version, which it more or less took the idea of Teach for America, but made it one of its own programs. And the year that when I was doing it, they were also offering you a master's degree that you would earn at the same time at one of the various universities in New York City. And I, for example, I was doing my master's, an education master's through NYU.
Mm-hmm.
So I had signed up for a 2-year obligation, a 2-year program. I was in the Bronx.
Yeah, that was another question I had. Did you have any say over where you were going? Because I remember one of the criticisms of Teach for America was it was expediting. Some people felt, anyway, and I don't know what their motivations were, is that the short preparation time, the short training time, which in some places, I mean, it might have varied around the country, was as little as 5 weeks, wasn't enough preparation. In exchange, so my question, I guess, would be, in exchange for this expedited process of being able to get into the classroom, were you just like assigned someplace like, hey, here's your job, or maybe the piece? That, really?
Yeah.
How about that?
Well, I was accepted and they said, come to New York City June 15th. Your program starts. There was some sort of reception meeting and we were in some amphitheater down in Manhattan. That's when I found out where I would be living, because essentially I had moved from Portland, staying with a friend in Williamsburg. I had no idea, I believe, at the time where I would be living. And then at that meeting, I found out, oh, you're going to go to the Bronx. And I think I also found out what specialty I would be teaching in, which I don't recall if I had requested anything. I was put into ESL, English as a Second Language.
Right.
And I had subsequently moved up to the area that I was going to teach in. So I was on 204, the Grand Concourse, and the school, the area was, as far as I remember, about 95% Hispanic. Most of the neighborhood I was living in spoke Spanish.
How long did you actually wind up doing that job?
Well, I stuck it out for a year.
Mm-hmm.
After a year, I realized that, to be honest, I felt like it was shuffling deck chairs on a Titanic.
Oh, yeah. Understand what you're saying.
One of the stories that amused me to no end, I think the first meeting I had with the district people, they asked the ESL people from the program, in the first half hour, they said, well, what's great about working in our district is that we have lots of great training, and then in a few years, you can go up to White Plains and get 20 or 30,000 more a year. And I just was, I was amazed. The cynicism of that, of bringing people in and encouraging them to essentially make use of the resources available in the school district in terms of training and then go to better pastures, I guess.
So these inner city schools were treated like an obstacle course that you had to navigate to kind of get a merit badge. And obviously, and then the merit badge is a huge raise and you move to, you know, upstate Westchester County. Yeah, I wonder how that feels for the people in that community, in that school, to just see people. I mean, I don't know if kids perceive or understand really what's going on, but people, you know, dragging themselves to work every day for a couple of years and then scooting out to someplace that's considered to be greener pastures.
The sense that I had was, on a certain level, the kids understood the whole arrangement. But I mean, to be fair, you know, the teachers that I worked with at the school, I felt that everyone there generally cared. And there was a sense of we're just all trying to work together to do the best we can with the situation. Other than there was a few students that were from former Yugoslavia, most of the rest of the staff was people of color.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I just remember, I mean, the reason that I thought of that question is I remember working with inner city kids in this boarding school. Obviously, there was pretty common precociousness, but when I was a new staff, you know, kids like 13, 14, 15 years old were basically doing the orientation for me. You know, here's how the politics of this place work. So which I thought was interesting because the staff wasn't telling me that, you know, like here's some things you really need to be aware of. But the kids understood it completely. What was going on?
I lucked out in that I had a mentor that was assigned a vice principal at another school and had been a vice principal for a long time and was now a mentor in the program. She was wonderful. In terms of a mentor, she was all that I could have hoped for. But, I mean, one of the stories that for me typifies the whole experience was I had four classes that I was in charge of. Two were straight ESL type classes, one in sixth grade, one in eighth grade. Another class I had was a special ed class. I had no special ed training. And then another class was a history class. And the work that I was doing in terms of the NYU, there was a boot camp for about 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then during the school year, there was once a week we had an evening of the classes. So there was some theoretical, some sort of practical training in that end. But most of it was just sort of throw you in the pool, sink or swim. Mm-hmm. So this class that I had for the history, the text that I was given was essentially too difficult for even the native speakers there. But most of these kids that I had were mostly new immigrants. They'd been in the country a couple of years. So they're junior high age. Some of them are high school age. And obviously they don't care at all about American history. They have some basic communication English, but they don't have any academic English. And you know, as I said, the textbook was even considered inappropriate for the regular students. So it was just a joke.
I haven't checked in on this in a while, but do they have versions of textbooks that are written for different interest groups? Like I know there's something about the textbook adoption process, right? So they cut certain things out of the books they want to get approved in Texas, right? Mm-hmm. So the Texas Book Approval Board will say, yes, this is presents a favorable account of what has happened in Texas during American history. So there is some tailoring of the books to certain areas. But I mean, just from my experience with a similar group of people, we worked in a school that had limited resources, and I would go to the library and I would look for things and I'd be like, none of this is for these kids. You know, why would any of them be interested in any of these stories? You know, I eventually wound up bringing in, when I was a history teacher, bringing in Howard Zinn. Because it was so iconoclastic and it was so, you know, potentially controversial. It was the only prayer I felt like I had. And obviously, I was a big believer in that lens of history at the time. Are there any materials that are written for a population like that? I never found anything.
I think it was understood that you just had to come up with your own thing. And I tried for a while to follow the ideas from, you know, that was coming from the NYU about how to teach history and how to teach it to in an ESL fashion, so to new speakers of English. So, for example, I spent a lot of time on the, you know, the immigration narrative in American history, thinking that, well, you know, they can relate to this and maybe it'll be useful. And I spent a lot of time on it. And then my vice principal, not my mentor, but the vice principal in the school, called me into his meeting almost as if he'd remembered that I existed. And Ed said, "Oh, Mr. Sturdivant, oh, yes, how's your history class going?" And I began to tell him what was going on. And he just said, "Well, you haven't done a damn thing." And he said, "Well, here's what we're going to do. Here's the syllabus. You're going to write a sheet of notes to highlight the points that the students need to know, and that's going to be sufficient for covering the material." And I understood that it was, in a way, he was doing me a favor. He was covering my ass and his ass and so forth. So we would be, I don't know what inspector would accept that as. But anyway, that was covering the material. So, it was basically after trying what I was being taught in terms of the training I was receiving within one part of the school system, another part of the school system said, "No, that's really not going to work here." So it was just that after that, it was really kind of a babysitting job and trying to salvage some aspects of teaching that I could live with.
Going through the motions is what I often felt like I was doing. And sounds like the same thing where, idealism is always at the beginning. Then you kind of get into the reality of the situation. You see what the limits are that are going to be placed on you as far as circumstances or environments or, school politics or the population. And, it really just came down, as far as I was concerned, both through student teaching and the actual paid experience that I had, that it wasn't a learning environment.
Not at all. It was essentially to keep the kids off the street. And, I don't think anyone was under any illusions. I mean, people tried and there was learning going on. But it's certainly, as far as I was concerned and what I was capable of doing at that point, I was utterly unprepared. And it was essentially that's part of the whole program is essentially to take people that are. They have professional skills, but see if they can, make a go at it in teaching. Teaching is one of those interesting professions where you can do it without really having proved that you can do it.
Indeed, yeah. I think Teach for America is an example of that, for sure.
In some ways, you might say it follows some sort of, in the most generous way, an apprentice-type idea, but so much of it is filling in these gaps in the system with anything that they can hope to fit. And I remember reading, this in the New York Times, the editorials from Board of Ed president or chairman, whatever, Joe Klein. Things were happening in the program and, knowing what was actually happening in experience. And as you can imagine, what was being sold in the newspapers and what was happening on the ground were, it was just a joke.
Sure. I want to go back to something you said a minute ago about the apprenticeship idea. I got access to the classroom of one teacher during my entire time preparing in Massachusetts for the secondary education history certification exam. So I had to do student teaching for a period of months. I had to obviously perform and be observed by an advisor and all that. But, in an apprenticeship, just for people who are unfamiliar, just to distinguish, I mean, you're right. It does have some parallels. But, I just think about my conversations with Gino Denning about apprenticeship. And there's nothing that's going to stop a young prospective teacher from getting stuck in a classroom with somebody who's been there for 30 years. And this was 2002 and 2003. So maybe they were very idealistic in 1974, but those days are long gone and they're pretty jaded and frustrated. And I remember one kid getting kicked out of class and sent to the principal's office for nothing. And I was stunned by her back talking or something so minor. Mm-hmm. And so I would have liked to tour, in an ideal world, I would have liked to tour around Drury High School in North Adams, Massachusetts, and, see what the different history teachers were doing, but it was an assignment. The person I was with was okay, but they weren't dynamic or interesting or particularly compassionate from what I remember. And so you are introduced to the actual everyday environment of the school through somebody who might not be a good mentor at all and might be a first big step in your enthusiasm for the profession getting crushed.
Well, I would say that one of the advantages I had in the program is the group that I was in with NYU, we met, we were together for the summer, so there was a lot of support and connection there that was built. There was one woman in my school who had been in the program the previous year. Also within the school, I had some access. You know, I shared a room with another teacher. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't quite as bleak as what you put forth, but it was still certainly very inadequate.
Yeah.
To say the least. You know, I just didn't know what the hell I was doing. And, you know, I was trying to learn as I went. But, you know, in a situation like that, I think that it would require not an amateur teacher, but a master teacher to really do well in a setting as challenging as that. And I certainly was far from that, despite my interest and the time that I put into it and everything. So, I mean, after the year, I got through it. I survived it. I realized that I could do another year. I would get better. And there were things that I enjoyed about it. You tell people, I was in the Bronx, and you know, they instantly just think of gangster rappers and all this sort of ghetto nightmare tales. And I had some run-ins, and mostly it was just me being an inexperienced teacher. Mm-hmm. But in general, you know, I think that, you know, the young people there, they understand who's real and who isn't. And, you know, if you're just a regular human being to them, they'll respond like any human being does, you know?
Right.
And I essentially after that year, I just decided that it wasn't for me, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I actually applied to the Peace Corps, and the Peace Corps said yes to me. And they said, well, you wait for a while we're getting your paperwork ready. So that's why I had about a 6 to 9 month window of waiting. So I said, well, I'll go to Turkey. I'd been there on vacation a couple of times, and so I knew that I could just sort of hang out there and teach in a language school easily while I was waiting. And so that's what brought me to Turkey.
And you've been there since?
I have been there since, ever since. It's been – so I got here September of 2003, so over 10 years now.
Oh, wow. So, first of all, fun question, and then I want to ask – because you're the first person I've ever talked to who I think has been to Turkey or is in Turkey – have you checked out this Göbekli Tepe place?
Oh, Göbekli Tepe. Yeah. I haven't been there, but my wife is Turkish. She's an archaeologist. So
you're kidding me. You know, wow.
So that place is that's a Neolithic site. Her specialty is classical archaeology, so it's not necessarily her bailiwick, but I am somewhat familiar with it.
So just for the people in the audience who are unfamiliar, my understanding is that Göbekli Tepe is essentially this complex, not quite a city, but this very, very old complex that they unearthed with all of this elaborate artwork and relief sculptures that predates any human civilization by thousands and thousands of years. I think it's been dated back to something like 10,000 BC.
Yeah, that's what I understand as well, that it's pushed back our ideas of when cities came about. Yeah.
So it's completely anachronistic with what even my understanding was of the development of civilization in the Middle East and then on to Egypt and then further west. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here, prior to any of that stuff, there's evidence of what was a pretty developed culture. Mm-hmm. And I also understand that there's a lot of evidence that the compound was covered deliberately, which is interesting, that it appeared to have been filled in at some point.
Filled in terms
dirt.
Of...
Like I mean, basically buried, yeah.
Recently or by...
No, they say that the dirt... I'm trying to get this right. The dirt that was covering it, they believed that it wasn't placed there long after most of the stuff in the city was built. Hmm. In the context of a 12,000 year time period.
Okay.
So it was like, in other words, it wasn't filled in like
process of erosion and or sedimentation and stuff. Okay.
No, it appears to have been deliberately covered, which is very strange. And it also contains a fair amount of it goes without saying that it would be architectural novelties since it predates everything else. I mean, so even if it was discovered to have been, built in 2000 BC, it had a lot of things that it would have been, pioneered then.
Sure.
So anyway, I found that was interesting, but it must just be generally a fascinating place to be if you're interested in history and architecture.
Definitely. I mean, for example, my wife's we live in Ankara, which is in the kind of in the center, and her family grew up in a village outside of Ankara by about 30 miles. And there's I think in the 2nd century AD, a small Celtic tribe from France essentially signed up with one of the emperors to be auxiliaries, and he stationed them in this area. And so essentially, it's very likely, I mean, my wife's family has lived in that part of Turkey for as long as they remember, so it's entirely likely that, perhaps some of her ancestors came from these Celts that were Roman auxiliaries in the 2nd century AD. And, Turkey has been the crossroads. It's been a strategic point in the world probably since that city that you mentioned came about. So anyone who was ever, anyone has been through here, has conquered, has passed through it, and the remains are still here.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, is that all of these divergent cultures have at one time or another had to, like you said, occupy or at least travel through that area. So the history there is extremely rich. Today, and this is my second question, most of us here in the West are familiar with the fact that there's been quite a bit of turmoil in Turkey lately. So I would ask if you could, before we go into your actual experiences teaching, what's the political environment and the results of that, politics and government over the last couple of years?
Well, the last spring, there was a city park in the center of Istanbul, and this park was in a part of Taksim. Taksim, think of Taksim as sort of, if you think of Istanbul as the New York City, if you will, then Taksim is kind of like Manhattan.
Sure.
And the park, the city essentially said, we're going to build a shopping mall in this green space. And this had been part of a number of development issues where the city had come in and essentially it was understood that cities, their buddies, were going to get to build something commercially related. And the people in the area just said, enough. We're tired of these sorts of things. They're not following their own rules. And it wasn't just that event. That was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
It was a reaction to corruption, could we say?
And just a series of the government essentially being very powerful and just saying, well, like it or not, this is what we're doing.
How do they describe the form of government to the people, right? So, like, we have stories in this country about what form of government we're supposed to think we have. So what do they tell people there? And would you say is the typical engagement, and how the people who responded to what happened last spring, how were they perceived by the mainstream?
They consider themselves a democracy. They throw that word around a lot. At the same time, they say we recognize that we're not as democratic as they are in the West, so to speak. And so, but we're getting there. We're working on it. We're making the reforms and so forth. Essentially, the current government is a conservative government with lots of backing by a moderate Islamic middle class who has risen in the last generation and is sort of vying for power with another power bloc that has I would say, centered more around the west of the country. So from Istanbul, and there's a secular and religious divide that's involved in this. Essentially, the current, I mean, the prime minister he was trained as an imam.
Yep. Okay.
And so his backing is quite strong. And so, I mean, for example, one of the things that he's quoted as saying, you know, to the organizers and so forth of the that park is called Gezi Park. He said, well, you can bring, you know, 100,000 out in the street. I've got 1 million I'll bring out in the street. So my sense was, you know, there was a lot of belligerence, and rather than de-escalating the conflict, it was sort of escalated.
Sure. Now, because of where Turkey is, like we mentioned before, it has a very interesting and important geographical position. And you're talking about reform movements coming from the western part of the country. Is it fair to say, in a lot of these questionable boundary places in the Middle East, as far as like how the boundaries were drawn and how the modern version of the country took its final shape? There's obviously better examples than Turkey, like Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia. But can you see, I don't know, like a blending or a transition of culture from west to east? Because just if people are unfamiliar, the western part of the country is very close to Greece. The country basically extends all the way to the north of like Iraq, and it borders Iran just a little bit, right?
Yeah, at the very northeast, you have Georgia, and then you have Armenia, then Iran, Iraq, Syria, and then the Mediterranean and the Aegean, and then you have Greece and Bulgaria, and then across the Black Sea, then you have Russia and...
Yeah.
There's a couple things. One, when you mention Iran and Iraq, essentially Turkey was slated after World War I to be another version of that. Essentially, the Allies in World War I made agreements about who was going to get what in Turkey. You know, the British had propped up Turkey for quite a while, because essentially in the 1870s, the Russians almost captured Istanbul. It was only the British Navy that stopped them. Mm-hmm. The British were following their normal policy of playing one side off the other. And so they didn't want the Russians to take hold of Constantinople, as it was known then, Istanbul now. I mean, essentially, the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century was known as the sick man of Europe. Mm-hmm. And in the late 1870s, there was a war with Russia. The Russians were basically on the outskirts of Istanbul, were threatening to take it. The British had warships in there. And essentially, they were just waiting for the time when they would deal with Turkey as they wished.
Right.
And so in World War I, the aftermath, that was that time. After World War I, you had Greek soldiers, French, Italians, essentially had landed in Turkey and were going to carve it up. Well, Mustafa Kemal, who's sort of their George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, all rolled into one.
Yeah.
Put a stop to that and essentially kicked all of foreigners out, if you will, and so and made it possible for there to be a modern Turkey. And then once he did that, he went on to a number of reforms, most significant of which is separating, because the Ottomans were the Sultan was also the Caliph. So he was also like the Pope, if you will, and the king, all rolled into one. Mm-hmm. And so Mustafa Kemal, who was part of that nationalist movements like that, you know, there was a whole group of them like that started in the late 19th century. And he was part of one known as the Young Turks. Mm-hmm. Well, he made a distinct division between church and state, if you will, or mosque and state, and really put the secular state idea in Turkey.
Yeah.
One thing I think many of your viewers may be familiar with, James Corbett and one of his partners, Sibel Edmonds. I highly recommend her work.
Sure, absolutely.
I'm sure that we could probably spend several hours talking about Turkey and stuff. I know that we're somewhat short on time, so I don't want to get lost in all of this.
I guess some groundwork that I would want to establish is a political environment and how it informs the pedagogy and, mm-hmm. and the school environment, because you know, that's where you work. So I guess we could sum up by saying that the country is ostensibly democratic, maybe mm-hmm. westernizing, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. I think it doesn't mean as much as people like to think it means, but becoming more secular. There's at least talk, or at least some miming towards a separation of church and state.
No,
would you say it's more real than that?
Well, I mean, for example, for a long time, I would say that it was very strictly secular. For example, as long as, you know, as recently as 10 years ago, or maybe even five, if you were a woman who wanted to wear a headscarf, you couldn't go into a public building. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the separation of church and state here is that the government actually has a ministry of religion, where essentially they underwrite the they're involved with the building of mosques, and they decide who will be the imams in the mosques. One of the conflicts that the current government is fighting is essentially one part of the country would like more religion in their government, and another part is terrified of that idea. Mm-hmm. In terms of the government and my school, I work in a private school, and I have worked in various private schools for the last 10 years, but the K through 12 and the universities are all essentially bound by the Ministry of Education for the way they do things. There's a certain amount of latitude, but a lot of it is run from the top-down model is very prevalent. So the government is ever present in the school, even in the private schools.
Interesting. Yeah, I had to, obviously it's the same here. That was where I learned a lot about government when I was working in a private school. And I had obviously learned or government involvement in education, I should say. I obviously learned about it a lot when I was in graduate school, but I really get to see it actually in private school. So are you basically just doing language instruction there, or what do you teach today?
I teach in a high school, and I teach the ninth grade. There's two components. There's a writing and reading class, and then there's a listening and speaking class. And I'm in. I share the listening and speaking class responsibilities for the ninth grade of about 100. Well, I guess it would be 200 students in the ninth grade.
That's interesting. So, what is listening and speaking?
Yeah, the one thing that's interesting about in the education model. So, for example, in universities, a lot of universities in Turkey are actually moving towards or are English medium, and so they're basing their system on the American university style.
Yeah.
But the English as a foreign language instruction has really been, the market's really been cornered by the British in terms of their teaching certificates and their approach to teaching. And I would say in terms of methodology, what's currently in vogue is what is considered a skills-based approach. So essentially looking at learning the language through breaking it down into, you know, your basic skills of writing and reading, those being paired together, and listening and speaking being paired together. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a lot of your modern, a lot of your textbooks, your course books follow that model. You know, there's, of course, grammar instruction and vocabulary instruction woven in there, but the idea is to learn the language through using those skills and developing those skills.
Now, here in the United States, obviously, there's always talk about the great disparity in quality between the private and public schools. What sends people into private schools in Turkey? What's the quality of public education like?
And yeah, yeah.
Is it similar to the United States or
I would
not?
That the people in Turkey, the middle class, and essentially anyone with money, has voted with their feet, and if they can at all afford it, they send their children to a private school, mm-hmm. K-12, which represents a significant investment on their part. Now, essentially, the way it works is, in Turkey, if you university is more or less free. I mean, the tuition is nominal. Your course, room and board, that's on you. So, essentially, at the end of high school, there's a high-stakes entrance exam, but if you do well on that, then you have a chance to get into a great university and have a, basically a nominal fee for, a pretty good education in terms of college, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So people essentially say, well, it amounts to another tax, really.
Is their system publicly and privately basically built on the Prussian philosophy and Prussian model of education? Because honestly, I really don't know anything about it. I mean, I know how the Prussian system obviously spread a little bit east and a little bit west, and actually a lot west, all the way over here, and as far east as Japan. But I'm hoping that even in government systems, it is not, dominating the world. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on, if that is, there's evidence that it influenced your system.
Oh, certainly, certainly. I mean, without a doubt, it's the same. I mean, for example, one of the customs, I suppose this is very much like a British model, is when the teacher comes into the room, the students are expected to stop everything that they're doing and stand quietly at attention at their desks until the teacher, basically tells them that they can sit down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that is, indicative of the whole attitude towards students and teachers. The system, the education system, is still relies on rote memorization. As I said, that high stakes exam, essentially, a lot of the high school experience is about cramming for exams. Cramming for every exam, and then your senior year, you cram for another year. In fact, oftentimes, the students will, after they graduate from high school, may take another year off and just spend it at a cram school.
Oh, wow.
For another year, just to get ready for this college entrance exam.
So, okay. Well, that sounds very familiar, aside from the extra year. I mean, I know a lot of people do PG years here, post-grad, but a little bit different than what you're talking about. So in similar educational environments and not a totally foreign and inconceivable political environment for Americans, I'm interested to hear what the students are like, what your experiences are with young people there.
Well, I mean, they're remarkably similar to Americans. I would say that they're not as their clothes. For example, in Turkey, everyone wears their school uniforms.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in Ankara, the public space is essentially shopping malls, and the shopping malls are just like anywhere else. There's Gap, there's Starbucks, there's Apple. So that is there's a global consumer culture that Turkey is a part of as well. And mm-hmm. I would say that's a westernizing force, if you will. You don't see as much in terms of the teenage rebellion in terms of the dress, tattoos, crazy hairdo, piercings and that sort of thing. I think that families just wouldn't stand for that. And they would be very harshly treated for those sorts of things in general.
And that's because of cultural and religious influence, most likely?
Yeah, I think so. You see it from time to time, but it's just not as that sort of personal expression is just not as common here. One thing that occurred to me, I thought about earlier, and in line with a lot of things I've heard in your show, is Ataturk was one of those men that came out of the 20s and 30s, one of those leaders like Mussolini, Franco. He was that sort of strong man, but his image has never tarnished in Turkey. In fact, they wish that another strong leader like him would show up and show them how it's done, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that this is a huge part of the identity of Turkey. I mean, for example, in all the classrooms, Atatürk, his picture is on the wall, and the beginning of the week we sing the national anthem in his direction, and at the end of the week we do that again. And essentially every public space, you're likely to find, you know, all the town squares and all the municipal buildings, everywhere is, you'll find his face. He's someone that if you talk unflattering about his record, you will, it's dangerous.
What do you think the consequences would be? Are we talking about like legal punishment, or somebody, you know, throws an egg at you, or somebody scolds you? Like how serious is that?
Well, I mean, it would depend. I mean, for example, I mean, essentially the current administration has made some comments about Atatürk that, you know, a lot of the secular side, you know, he's their saint. And so there, you know, in the last generation, it's become more acceptable to start to essentially look at who he really was, and, you know, he's human, and he but for example, you would never find a stand-up comedian in Turkey, which there are a few. I don't believe they would ever be able to do a routine in which they said anything about him. I think that they would, I mean, they probably would not be hot, you know, they would probably never get a job, and they would, you know, I could imagine that they would be killed by some person after, you know, in the parking lot, so to speak. I can just see
wow.
it. And they look at Atatürk as saving them from what happened to the rest of the Middle East at the hands of the West in a lot of ways.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because it is quite, I mean, obviously there's some similarities, but it is quite distinct from the rest of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a very, very thoughtful man. He was very clear. For example, he did not have any children himself because he was worried about any sort of, succession or dynasty. He did adopt a young girl. I mean, from what I understand, you know, he was given all sorts of honors, and he was given lots of land and homes and things, and he went back to the state. So, I mean, from what I understand, he was really genuinely interested in trying to do what was right, what he what he thought was right for the country.
And people who believe that often tend to come to embrace this idea that it's okay to be heavy-handed.
Oh yes, you know,
'cause you're
yes.
doing God's work.
Oh, there was certainly, I mean, for example, in there's a lot of books about Turkey. There was one that I remember years ago called A Fez of the Heart. And Atatürk made many reforms. And for example, one of them was a reform in the way people dressed. And he outlawed the fez and essentially made it a capital offense to, you know, hang on to some of this traditional clothing. And some people in Turkey, I think in the 20s and 30s, they decided that it was worth to their life to hold on to these things. So yes, heads did roll. You know, he was not above spilling blood in order to push forth the reforms that he thought that the country needed.
With all this groundwork being laid, we want to return to the classroom and talk about, you know, your observations there.
Certainly. You know, there's things that occur to me, I mean, in terms of the issues that have come up, my observations on, you know, the students, you know, my understanding of the school system. I mean, one thing that's for sure is the school system itself, the entire K through 12 builds up to a single test that the students take in their senior year. And the other thing that's important to understand is I believe that it's very difficult for students to change their major once they get to university.
Really, why is that?
I'm not really certain, but I've known a lot of people that, you know, their families are very influential in their choice, you know, so this typical, you know, choose, you know, go for med school or engineering or law rather than maybe something that your heart's really more set on.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the situation where young people are building their whole life towards taking a test in their senior year or the year after and making choices that, you know, they're gonna have to live with for their whole life based on this occupation that they're building on. And I would also say that, you know, in the U.S., certainly when I was growing up, I think I graduated from high school in 1989, and there was still this sense of sort of the liberal arts aspect of education, that the idea of becoming a, you know, a well-rounded person through an advanced education. And
mm-hmm.
Turkey, it seems very clear that it's very much about the job, that you'll get a good job if you go to school. The students are very driven towards performing on this test, and anything that doesn't really fit into that in their way of thinking, you know, they just don't have time for that.
So, like, good stuff is, I mean, it certainly doesn't sound too unfamiliar, right? Like, good stuff or other interests or other pursuits are crowded out by the compulsory stuff.
Yeah. And also just the sense that if it doesn't fit into a nice, clean, multiple choice answer that someone else can give me, I'm not so interested in that sort of mindset I've come across a lot is. In the work I do, I try to really encourage critical thinking. I really try to keep that in mind when I'm designing my lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real struggle because, you know, in a lot of ways, the rest of their schooling is not really requiring that of them.
I don't know. Let me get your comment on this, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is something that people tell me is happening here. What you're saying is you want to add this stuff in, but it's not part of the curriculum, and the curriculum is very busy, and things have to be checked off a list, right? So here, teachers are actually writing the number of the standards, like the specific item
mm-hmm.
in the state standards, on the boards, and the kids are supposed to record it into their notes, so when the bean counters come around, they can go and see that the kids are getting this stuff, that they...
Yeah, and there is some sense of stuff like that. I think that people talk about, you know, so-and-so, this director likes this or that, but that doesn't seem there's a lot of traction around that. But, you know, in Turkey, we have a Ministry of Education which sets a national curriculum. And there are inspectors that come around to make sure that they're following it. And, I mean, certainly the inspectors undoubtedly know that they're just getting – a special show for when they're there, and that's not necessarily how things really go when they're not there. It's just, you know, everyone plays this game, just like I'm sure everywhere in the world where this sort of, you know, the inspectors come. It's just the usual school dance. But
do you feel, I know we talked a little bit about the political environment before, but do you feel, and you know, if you don't know, you don't know, but do you feel like there's a strain of pushback or disobedience in what people are doing? Like you say, the inspectors have to come around. Mm-hmm. I remember being in graduate school and people talking about being upset about some of the things they had to do, but they never questioned the fact that they had to do it. You know, they're like, oh, well, too bad, I have to do this. But, you know, what would you say? Like, the word disobedience comes to mind. Does it exist there beyond just what we talked about in the political context?
So would you be saying something like within a school setting, would there be teachers that know, you know, that according to this diktat that they should be doing this, but they're going to do something that they think makes more sense in terms of for the students' needs, that sort of, is that what you're referring to?
Well, you talked about your experience, how you're, you know, relatively young, right? You haven't been there for 30 years getting beaten down by the system. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a lot of that here, a lot of idealism in education. But what I've said so many times on my show is, like, whether we're talking about law enforcement or academia or psychiatry or secondary school teaching, these are very, very obedient professions by and mm-hmm. large. So I'm just wondering if that seems to be, you know, the same there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a conservative field.
Yeah.
In terms of, in working in the private sector here is, you know, you have similar dynamic as of opposed to the public school sector in teaching, because it's difficult for anyone who works for the government to be removed. It's more likely that they might be transferred, but certainly not removed. Within the private school, there's certainly a lot more fear among teachers about compliance, about pleasing parents.
So what you're saying, though, is you think there would be, when we're just talking about resistance or people going their own way, you would more likely see that in public settings than private?
No. I wouldn't say that. I mean,
yeah, because that would surprise me.
Yeah, no. I wouldn't say that at all. But in my experience with in the private setting, it's just very easy for teachers to be fired. So there's a lot more fear of compliance, I think, in the private setting here than in the public setting, as far as I know. I mean, you know, I volunteered a little bit when I first came to Turkey, worked in a public school in a very poor area of Istanbul, partially because one of my students at the school that I was teaching in the evenings was an English teacher there. And I, having come from the Bronx teaching, I understood her plight, and I was also curious about what school was like, you know, sure, the public school setting. And, but, you know, from what I gather, there's the teachers who teach in public school, they're not paid as much, but they have a lot more benefits in terms of pensions and, you know, essentially, yeah, once you're in the system, you're in. However, there is this thing about when you start off being a teacher in the public school staff situation, they send you to another part of the country. You don't have a choice of where you go. So they essentially, you might end up teaching in some, you know, one room schoolhouse in a village out in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
And you do that for 5 years, and then you get to, apply to teach where you would like to teach. So
it sounds like they have like their own version of Teach for America.
Yeah. It's just built in. It's understanding like, well, you time at the beginning, and once you do that, then you can go, then we'll let you teach where you'd like to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Turkey has Turkey still has a mandatory military service for all the 18-year-olds. The men, at least, not the women, of course.
What kind of effect does that have? Because, I mean, you've been able to see what young people look like in both places. I mean, is that something that people dread? Is it something they have been kind of indoctrinated to look forward to? Has anyone talked about it? Do people, you know, what would you say your observations have been on this mandatory military service? Also, by the way, being discussed here.
Well, one thing to recall is that Ataturk, who is sort of, as I mentioned before, is like their George Washington, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, all rolled into one. He was not only apparently a brilliant military mind, but very effective in bringing out some really important social reforms and pushing through reforms that have founded the modern nation. You know, he did that on the force of his military experience, and he is, still remains a national hero. His face is everywhere. He's on the money. They have their own version of the Pledge of Allegiance, is saying at the beginning of the week and at the end of the week. And, you know, you turn your face towards him when you sing this song. The one part of the country is relatively well off and very European in respect. And another part of the country is dirt poor. And in a ways, the army serves a very, I've heard stories, people telling me of, you know, that they knew of men who had, when they join the army, is the first time they've actually experienced an indoor toilet. And there's a lot of things going on with that. Now, for example, I understand that every now and then the army changes their regulations on, for example, the ability to essentially buy your way out of military service. The tour can be anywhere between 5 months to a year. But I do get the sense that it's something that the country as a whole is beginning to question, if they're going to switch to the professional army, so to speak, that the U.S. switched to after, in the wake of Vietnam.
I'm interested because it sounds like it's also viewed as kind of a welfare program, right? So it seems like it would be more sustainable there, that people would question it less, because it's, I shouldn't say they're I guess I forget about political divisions here as here, and that they probably exist there as well, because people aren't, I was going to say, people aren't questioning the welfare system here, but they certainly are. It's just the people who are benefiting from it are not questioning it by and large. So
I would say that in some ways it does seem to be sort of a rite of passage. It's something that, you know, if you don't share anything in common with another man in Turkey, you can be sure that you can share your stories of, you know, your horror stories of being in the military. And I've heard stories from the men, and they're atrocious. I mean, it's just between, you know, the obvious, you know, stories of fighting boredom and endless exercises of learning your left from your right, but actually, you know, your life being put in danger over just stupid things, you know, just that those, you know, the reality of life in any military.
Right.
And Turkey has its own terrorists and has been fighting a war, low intensity conflict with these terrorists over the Kurdish issue.
Do you think we could nutshell that for people? Because I know we've heard these terms before, mm-hmm. but what's just the basics of that, or at least the official story of that?
To bring it back, when Turkey was formed in the sort of the wreckage of World War I, the Ottoman state was a multicultural state. And though the ruling class had originally come from Turkish warlords who had conquered the area, they had since sort of separated themselves from their original Turkish roots, if you will. Turkey, when it was formed, you had all of these different ethnic groups. So, for example, the Russians would say, well, we see ourselves as protectors of the Orthodox community within the Ottoman Empire. And so there was these divisions ethnically within the empire. And so one of the things that Ataturk did was he really created this ethnic identity of the Turk. And so all these other identities were sort of flattened out, sometimes literally. So in the last generation, the Kurdish people have gone from not being able to teach their own language to their children and having some really brutal practices that essentially to try to keep them in the fold. And one thing that's important to realize is that, you know, about 20% of the population of Turkey is ethnically Kurdish. Same in Iraq. About 10% of Iran is ethnically Kurdish, and another few percentage of Syria is ethnically Kurdish. So Kurds is traditional homeland, you know, in the midst of these other nations, if you will.
Yeah, kind of same situation in Afghanistan. Like, there's people there who are part of an ethnic group that don't really understand that there's a border called Afghanistan and Pakistan, and don't really care either, to their credit. And it seems like that's what I've understood about the Kurds, too, is that they're kind of spread. There's like a Kurdish belt that extends across some very different parts of the Middle East, at least politically, mm-hmm. right? Like from Turkey to Iraq, for sure.
Yeah. And within them, they're, you know, the Kurds have as far as I understand, a very tribal structure of in terms of how they relate to each other. And so within that, there isn't necessarily one monolithic Kurdish group. There are different tribes, different loyalties, some of them, you know, and I think this fact has been used to ally one group against the other. Certainly the northern Iraq, which is largely Kurdistan now, has been something that's been very worrying for Turkey and its, you know, issues with the Kurds. You know, and like I said, it's an ongoing low-intensity conflict. Every so often, some soldiers are killed, or some terrorists, so to say, you know, as they're called, are killed. It's an ongoing thing here.
Mm-hmm. If there is this kind of constant threat, and everyone is going into service, unless, as you mentioned, they have the ability to buy their way out, it seems like it makes for a very stressful adolescence. I mean, that would be my speculation.
And the, you know, the service isn't, it's not as though you're necessarily, you know, if you join the army, you're headed towards a combat zone. I mean, there's little military bases all over the place, and so they are, you know, sent to go march around in some place where there's nothing to do but march around. I mean, it's just something that they have all these young men that are fulfilling their service, and they got to do something with them. So they send them. I'm sure there's a lot of waste and just needless resources spent on this. But I mean, I would say that as an institution, the army is generally very well respected. Because as I mentioned, the Constitution itself, you know, empowers the military to overthrow any government, which is, you know, essentially feels is too religious. And that happened as late as 1997. And, you know, the war in Syria has sent hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees into Turkey, and Turkey is shouldering a huge amount of humanitarian relief on that. It's also one thing that's very little known outside is, as far as I understand, a majority of the contracts that are held by foreign companies in Iraq are essentially Turkish contracts, Turkish companies. So Turkey's been in NATO ever since it started. So, and Turkey is quite proud of its involvement in the Korean War. So it's, you know, there's a lot of pieces in this puzzle. You know, you've got the EU, sure. You know, Turkey's right across the Black Sea from the Ukraine and Crimea. You know?
Yeah, it's,
you know, there
a lot of news coming out of that area for sure. Like all the time, not just right now. Like,
yeah, because it's. Yeah. As it has been at the center of global politics ever since there were global politics. And in that respect, I would say I get this sense that they've just seen it all before. They've seen it all before.
Yeah.
The thing that always comes back to me about Turkey, I'll start it out this way. When I was finishing, I did a master's degree in conflict resolution, and one of the courses I took was a games theory course, and we did a game called Barnga. It was designed by an Indian man whose either first or last name is Thyagi. I can't recall anymore, but this game is really fascinating. You take a regular deck of playing cards. You take the aces ace through sevens, and essentially you have four or five different groups of people, four or five players. And you give everyone the same deck of cards, but you give each group different set of rules. But you don't tell anyone that they have a different set of rules. So in one game, the ace is the best card. In another game, the seven. And in another game, you know, maybe the hearts are trump or something like this. And you tell people that in the first round, they're allowed to speak and they're allowed to make sure that everyone understands the rules. And then it's just a standard like bridge type, you know, you put your card down and whoever has the best card wins the trick. And at the end, there's a winner and there's a loser, someone who's gotten the most tricks and one who's gotten the least. And you tell the person who's won the most to rotate to one, you know, rotate clockwise to one group and the loser go counterclockwise to another. And then you tell everyone, now they must be completely silent, they must not talk, and they must continue playing. Now, at this point, everyone just assumes that, well, we're all just playing this card game. The cards are the same. And then after, instantly, in the next round, because at each game, there's now three sets of rules being played. But no one really, it takes a little bit of time to realize, well, wait, people aren't playing by the same rules as I am. And so a number of interesting things happen in that situation, you know, such as the first person who realizes that, wow, we're all playing by different rules. And so if I just take the cards, no one's going to tell me that I can't take the cards, you know, because there's this chaos. And this game, I played this game 15 years ago, and it's always stuck with me. And in Turkey, I learned this to see how this game is related to my situation, and that Turkey is, is close enough to my experience of America in terms of, you know, it's westernized. You know, when I tell a joke, you know, a lot of times, you know, people laugh at the joke. I mean, there's some, you know, in a lot of ways, we're playing by the same rules. Mm-hmm. But every now and then, there's a situation where it's clear that I'm playing by a different set of rules than the other person. And like that card game, no one is really able to explain it, what the rule is, because it's something that that we've internalized, like a fish that doesn't, you know, the fish doesn't know what water is. It's
right,
and
right.
So turkey is, you know, the cliche, it's the Middle East. So there's some aspects of it that are completely westernized and very familiar. And it's those aspects of it that, you know, lull me into this sense of, oh, I'm, you know, it's just like what I'm used to. And then every now and then, less frequently now that I've been here for 10 years, you know, something will just smack me upside the head and remind me that I'm a stranger in a strange land. And I have two children, two sons. I most likely will be here until they're finished with their education, K through 12, unless
I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
Something forces me to leave, which, you know, being the Middle East could be any number
World
of
War
things. III,
something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, I think this has been a very educational discussion about a very important, not just historically, but also in a current political context, place on Earth. And I appreciate that we were able to talk about the education there, being able to compare it to here. But, you know, as somebody who's interested in geopolitics and history, I have to admit, an underdeveloped area of knowledge for me. And I got a lot out of this conversation, and hopefully the audience will as well. I think they will.
I hope so. It's been a real pleasure to do this as well. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.